When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking September reopening, the skills agenda, UCAS data, and sexual harassment on campus. It's all coming home.
Where does that guidance leave us? It leaves us with essentially an unresolvable conflict. On the one hand, you have to fulfil your statutory duties in health and safety. On the other, you can't refuse access to people who won't wear face masks, other than obviously for health reasons, etc. You know, those are legitimate grounds for not wearing it. And you know, not only is the guidance not particularly useful, but I think in some cases it's actually, frankly, unhelpful.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and here for our season finale to help us kick about the HE policy ball this week, our three brilliant guests. In London, it's Richard Brabner, Director of the UPP Foundation. Richard, your hire to the week.
Well, we're recording this the morning after the night before, and it was absolutely amazing to watch England. In the first time England in my lifetime are going to be in a final. Can't believe it. It's coming home, although I prefer World in Motion, but there we go.
And in Birmingham, it's Peter Jamdar, Head of Education Practice at Shakespeare Martineau. Peter, you have to choose a different one.
Well, okay, I take that challenge on board and give to you Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest, which took place on the 5th of July and was won by Joey Chestnut, who ate 10,000 hot dogs or something. I don't actually know, but as I couldn't mention England and the triumph of deep woke, I'm now stuck with Nathan's hot dog eating contest.
Tasty. And in London, it's Wonky's editor, Debbie McVitie. Debbie, your highlight of the week.
Oh, I mean, how do we top that moment, really, when we were all sitting on the sofa just watching the ball hit the back of the net? It was incredible. Okay, my highlight of the week was I took Sammy to the park on Monday, and it briefly didn't rain.
A British summer for you. Okay, let's start the week with the big reopening of society and thinking ahead to September. The government has issued some guidance about how universities should proceed. It's fairly light touch, it should be said. Richard, what's happening here?
Yeah, so thanks, Mark. So, well, as all Wonky listeners know, the government announced its plans for lifting restrictions this week. And in terms of higher education, Gavin Williamson made a statement in Parliament on Tuesday that confirmed restrictions on in-person teaching and compulsory mask wearing on university campuses in England will end. And this was accompanied, as you mentioned, Mark, by guidance which says that institutions, and I quote, should not put in place measures which limit the teaching and learning outcome for students or significantly limit the wider activities offered by the HE provider. Well, I just want to say that obviously a couple of months ago when cases were low and the vaccine rollout was steaming ahead, many of us had obviously hoped that this would, if not be a joyous occasion, be one which brought some form of certainty and clarity to our lives. But given this is now happening with rising cases due to the Delta variant, there continues to obviously be a significant amount of uncertainty and nervousness. And clearly questions remain for universities on how they're going to operate in the autumn, given some of their students won't be double jabbed by then. And I'm sure we're obviously going to get into the discussion about all of this and what the sector should do and so on, and some of the commentary around online learning this week. But for me, what really matters, and I'm sure it does to all Wonky listeners, is putting students first. You know, in my view, in terms of the restrictions, young people have been impacted the most, and they've been absolutely amazing in putting the needs of others over their own needs. And, you know, whatever we decide to do going forward, we really need to put their learning and their experiences first.
I mean, it seems to me like this is just the latest of an extremely long line of examples of the government making it all the sector's problem when it comes to COVID and how to proceed. Am I right, Debbie?
I mean, you could say that. The thing that I think is interesting that changes is this question about what happens if you arrive at uni. So from July 19th, if you are double jabbed, you'll no longer be required to self-isolate. If you are either under 18 or you have had your two vaccinations. So yeah, there's this kind of pocket of students who may arrive at university without having had their two vaccinations. The thing I noticed actually was that people in that situation will be given a four month kind of grace period in which to get that jab. So I think that's actually quite, you know, the goal here is obviously just to get as many jabs in arms as possible. And I think it's quite smart to put that incentive in place in that way. Although obviously there may be some who, for whatever reason, are unable to receive the jab, and then they're going to need kind of special care and attention. But yes, I mean, I think universities have learned by now that government will not be rushing to the rescue, other than by sort of issuing guidance to say, you know, you must make the best of this as you possibly can.
And it's become a whole thing about blended learning and tuition fees this week in the media, hasn't it? Because I mean, there's long running refrain in some parts of the media that says kind of online learning is second rate to in-person learning, or to the extent where it should be, you know, it should be cheaper somehow, even though that obviously doesn't make any sense. For anyone that works in university understands that it's not cheaper to deliver it all online, is it, Smita?
It definitely isn't, Mark. And I suppose for me, the conversation this week and the issuing of the guidance, etc., has really reinforced the rather dispiriting trend of not being able to have nuanced conversations about incredibly complex issues. And so if you take the issue around blended learning, for years we've been talking about the fact that the future is almost inevitably going to involve some more element of use of technology to teach and learn, because every other area of life has done that. Why wouldn't HE? And of course, what happened last year was a real acceleration of all that, and in some cases, an emergency reaction to that, not necessarily a planned one. But underpinning it was this overarching trend. So to suddenly say, well, we must go back to face-to-face, you mustn't be limiting any face-to-face access, does present blended as a kind of, you know, second rate option, and therefore cheaper. And none of that is actually sensible or true. And we should be able to have a much more nuanced conversation. But I could go on, you know, the guidance raises all sorts of issues where we should be having, nuanced conversations, which are not permissible, it seems, anymore.
I think the really tricky thing for universities here is making that really helpful distinction, if it is possible, for students, between the things that might be done because of COVID as a way of reducing transmission and kind of in a sense of, you know, cutting your coat to suit your cloth, and the things that might be done for pedagogical reasons because it actually leads to a better learning experience and better outcomes for students. And I think we're in the sort of worst possible world of universities have been thinking really hard and carefully about what this next normal looks like, what this kind of new blended looks like, and how to kind of use technology to enhance the learning experience, but it's coming across as if sort of saying this is our second rate offer. Students are desperate to be told the experience will be full and enriching this year because they've really struggled in the last 16 months. So it's partly a comms job, but it's also partly a sequencing job about not saying that, you know, from September we will be rolling out this marvelous new blended learning environment, because as much as that might be the hope, what students will hear is you're getting something that is second rate because of COVID. So that's got to be really, really finessed, I think.
Can I just come in from Debbie's point there? I completely agree in the sense that clearly there's been a lot of sort of half-informed comment this week around the news from Manchester that lectures are going to be online and so on, and wider universities and what they're going to do next year. But, our Student Futures Commission, which I'm sure many listeners know about, that launched in May. When we launched, we obviously ran some polling that Sybil platform from Group GTI did for us. Over 2,000 students and so on responded. And we found that obviously face-to-face teaching is the priority, but only 15% of students don't want any online delivery next year. And I think what's really key is the balance. You know, they want online to complement face-to-face, not face-to-face to complement online. So I think students will understandably be upset if the balance is tilted too far towards online, but will support changes if the balance is right. And to me, this, you know, as Debbie mentioned, this is as much about a communications issue, and it's really, universities will want to be clear as much as possible about the face-to-face contact their students are going to have and articulating what that balance is going to be.
And it continues to be a problem as well, doesn't it? That we talk about face-to-face and online as if they were different things. Because, of course, during the pandemic, they have been. One of the kind of key kind of, I think, points that I took away from discussions at Monkfest was the sort of saying we don't really know what blended means in the context of being allowed to meet face-to-face. Because, you know, when we talk about technology-enabled learning, we're often talking about groups of students sitting in a room, but using devices and using technology, or taking those conversations online, but then bringing them back into the classroom. So it's, you know, this kind of, the sort of idea that there's a sort of spectrum of, you know, from face-to-face to online is, I guess, one way of conceiving of it. But I think there are others that are probably more pedagogically exciting, should we say.
Mark, can I just move the conversation sort of slightly beyond the narrow issue of blended learning to the wider issue of the status of this guidance and how it fits with universities' other rights and duties. So the two I'm particularly interested in here are the idea, which is stated in the guidance, that institutions are autonomous and therefore are free to make decisions about how they choose to run their organisations. If you don't have autonomy to do that, it's a flipping feeble form of autonomy. And secondly, of course, duties such as health and safety law. And I think we're going to see some sort of pinch points. So, for example, the guidance says no student must be denied access to learning because of either their preparedness or otherwise to wear a face covering. And if an institution decides that in their local context, in the rooms that they've got and the capacity to ventilate, etc., face masks are a prudent health and safety step, where does that guidance leave us? It leaves us with essentially an unresolvable conflict. On the one hand, you have to fulfil your statutory duties in health and safety. On the other, you can't refuse access to people who won't wear face masks, other than obviously for health reasons, etc. You know, those are legitimate grounds for not wearing it. And, you know, not only is the guidance not particularly useful, but I think in some cases it's actually frankly unhelpful. And it does just confuse an already complex legal environment.
Well, is this about, I mean, the government has sort of long misunderstood or chosen to ignore kind of status of students as adults. And they seem to have this kind of weird other status that, you know, they're not pupils in school, and so they have a different, you know, institutions have different responsibilities there, but then also they're not just regular citizens.
Yeah, absolutely, because ultimately they are, you know, you've got institutions that have to make the right decisions for a whole community based on their very particular circumstances. I am rather worried that it's become a political point, hasn't it? Until the 19th of July, you must wear a face mask. And after the 19th of July, wearing a face mask is sort of tantamount to some form of civic failure. Well, surely there is, as I said earlier, room for nuance and room for understanding that in different scenarios, we might have to behave differently. Not according to this guidance, tragically.
And it's really a point about flexibility. And it's so exasperating that masks and other issues have become sort of some form of proxy culture war this week, which I find just ludicrous. And if government is going to hand it to universities to deal with, there needs to be a basis of trust, and there needs to be an understanding that in certain contexts, in certain different dynamics, as Smeet has just mentioned, universities are going to behave in a slightly in a different way depending on the context of the situation they're in. And we do need more trust-based government and trust-based governance on these issues.
I think yeah, well said. I think on that note as well, kind of going back to that point about putting the student first, I think, you know, whatever the kind of legal circumstances or public guidance, you know, lots of students will continue to be nervous. And that's sort of something we've seen. Students are not by and large gung-ho about the risk of catching COVID. They are, you know, a good proportion of them are and will continue to be nervous about the risks that they might pose to their own relatives if they catch it, about the risks to themselves. So, whatever the kind of circumstance or, you know, whatever guidance universities issue, I think we'll need to be quite sensitive to that, even if it's not a requirement to wear masks indoors, for example. So it again, it'll be a sort of tricky conversation potentially with student bodies who will have quite divergent views themselves on how things should be conducted moving forward.
I should say that most of this conversation so far has been about England, and you can find links in the show notes for discussion and analysis about what's going on in Wales and Scotland as well. Now, Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan, is here to talk us through the latest UCAS data.
As was widely expected, numbers are up for UCAS applications this year as of the 30th of June deadline, about 4% overall. This is testament to the continued attractiveness of higher education, speaks richly of the lack of other options for young people right now, and adds pressure to a system already strapped for physical capacity. On that, we can see evidence of high tariff providers becoming slightly more selective in offer making. Numbers are up, but not as much as applications, so offer rates are much lower than in previous years. More 18-year-olds from China have applied to UK universities than 18-year-olds from Wales, or Northern Ireland. And there's an utterly inexplicable peak of mature student applications from Nigeria. This comes along a significant collapse in applications from Europe, expected but still disappointing to see. The summer will not bring a repeat of last year's blazingly good news for access. The numbers of applicants are up for the polar fall quintile 1, but the proportion is down. We're not seeing any evidence of 19-year-olds having declined places last year only to apply this year. Reapplication rates are down at that age in the UK. The trend towards studying subjects that lead to careers shown at their most pivotal during the pandemic continues. More people want to become medics, nurses, other allied medical health professionals, and teachers. But there's also a growth in social sciences applications. Perhaps people want to know why as well as how. Conversely, there's a small drop in the proportion looking to study business, and language, at least at the top level, continues their painful decline. I keep coming back to the physical limitations of another bumper year. Do universities have the number of teaching rooms, labs, and lecture theatres needed to educate two record-breaking cohorts while keeping them safe from a resurgent pandemic? The rash of providers announcing more blended provision for September may have this issue in mind. It's certainly a trend to watch.
Now, the Skills and Post-16 Education Bill has been making its way through Parliament, and we've been thinking a lot on the site about the skills agenda and universities' role in it. Debbie, talk us through it.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So since the Skills White Paper was released back in January, and I suppose, you know, before that, stretching back to the Ogle Review in 2019, we've been thinking about some kind of quite key questions. Because I think the first thing to say is that the skills agenda is, you know, is really just the English version of a wider trend that we're seeing across the UK, you know, Wales and Scotland. We've seen movement in both those areas this week, and globally. So, you know, across the world, people are thinking more lifelong learning, more focus on skills and kind of, I guess, employer relevant, sorts of education, more use of technology, concern about the costs of developing a highly skilled population and addressing skills gaps. And different countries are approaching it in different ways. This is just the sort of English flavour. But I think that sort of, This agenda is sort of inextricable from that kind of broader kind of resettling and disruption of education and the purpose it sort of serves in 21st century society. So we're looking at the skills agenda in the context of some of those bigger trends, and asking, I suppose, kind of really, how big are these changes? How much is this something that is kind of new and different for universities that they need to prepare for? What will be the impact on university strategy, and just how disruptive will it actually be? Because of course you've got lots of people saying this is going to be incredibly disruptive for universities, and you know, the 3-year degree as we know it may disappear or shrink significantly, and others saying, yeah, this is pretty much business as usual. You know, maybe we can ramp up some activity here or there. So our colleagues at KPMG have kind of set out some of those arguments for us in terms of the scale of disruption, and they've done some thinking internally about that. And I've been talking to some university leaders to try and understand how nervous they are and what sorts of changes they're putting in place. And the other side of this, of course, is about some, you know, practical concerns. One is about further and higher education collaborating in places. And we know that this is such an important agenda. And I think trying to kind of understand what might be materially different as a result of this agenda. And we've had Anne Milton, former skills minister, writing about that on the site. And likewise, if any of this is going to work and we're going to see people accessing learning throughout their lives and accumulating credit and taking different modules and different providers, we will need to sort out credit transfer. So DK has written a piece about whether that's actually going to be possible and why there might be any reason to believe that, having looked at this many, many times in the past, that it'll be any different this time. So all of that is on the site, and I commend it to our listeners' attention.
Smita, you've long been a champion of further education and higher education collaborating more closely. Do you think this presents an opportunity to kind of kickstart that agenda?
It definitely presents the opportunity. Whether it will actually be taken or not, I don't know. There are, in the same way that Debbie's just outlined all the other things that we've talked about for a long time and haven't happened, HEFE collaborations clearly are up there. There's a bit of me that feels, however, that it surely cannot be the case that in every other area of life there has been transformation, and yet HE is going to carry on just the same as it was, or almost the same as it was decades ago. Things are going to have to change. And there's something quite exciting about some of the things that I think universities are already thinking about in terms of how to, what could change, and the flexibility and the innovation that we might start to see. But I think I go back to a point that Richard made towards the tail end of the last conversation, which is a lot of that would be much more achievable if there was a sense of trust between universities and government, and universities were seen as part of the solution, rather than where I think some parts of government see them, which is very much part of the problem. So I think that's the big challenge for universities. How do we move from where we are, where we're seen as the thing that needs fixing, to actually the thing that can fix so many of our skills conundrums? I think that's the conversation I'd be very interested in having if I was a sort of senior leader in a university.
Well, this is what struck me when I sat down with various vice chancellors, and, you know, and all, you know, from a range of different types of institutions, all really quite invested in, you know, delivering the right skills for their regions, and, you know, meeting the needs of students, and, you know, as you would expect, but also extremely kind of open to the skills agenda, very much sort of saying, you know, we're here, we're ready to do this, we're already doing a bunch of things in this area. And it seemed to me that actually in many ways, you know, of course, universities are autonomous, that, you know, and they, you know, particularly where there's great local relationships in place, a very clear strategy and a kind of plan, you know, to some extent, universities will kind of, will continue to flourish and do that well. But if government really wants the skills agenda to land and to be impactful and to make, you know, and to achieve the transformation it seeks, it's really missing a trick not working with universities. And, you know, and I think, and there is this sort of real sense, I think, of, you know, it, given the scale of disruption, having lots of individual universities respond to their local regions is one thing, but could government not sort of find the energy to perhaps muster a bit of a kind of, let's bring the further and higher education sectors together, let's work across the piece, let's think about this at the kind of you know macro level and really kind of get behind an agenda. You know, it just sort of seems sort of, it's really frustrating that just isn't what seems to be happening.
And I mean, Richard, the you know, if UCAS data this week is anything to go by, the demand for traditional 3-year full-time undergraduate degrees isn't slowing down. If anything, it's going the opposite way.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And this whole sort of debate, wider debate within sort of the current government circles is quite interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, you've got, you know, free marketeers on one hand, and you've got this growing scepticism on the right of markets, particularly amongst the sort of, you know, in glib terms, the post-liberals. And I think it's true, isn't it, that, you know, we, over the last few years, particularly in the coalition government, the greater freedoms that were given to sort of 18-year-old school leavers was good for them in many respects, but has undermined choices and freedoms for other students, particularly those that are sort of focused around place issues. You know, we don't have a system that fits around the lives of learners, and students rooted to place do have less choice as a result of policy, as a result of the sort of external environment that we're in. But, you know, I suppose my challenge back to government is, are we getting the balance right, or are we shifting too much in the other direction of control? You know, are we focused too much on skills that are needed today and not the businesses and skills of the future? And what if students don't want to study the subjects that the government seems to think are valuable? You know, are they going to be somehow shoehorned into things that they don't want to do or don't have aspirations for? You know, I'm really skeptical, Mark, that government knows better than students themselves on what and where to study. And yet there's lots of sort of powerful voices in Whitehall that have the opposite view of that. On just one final point in terms of collaboration with FE, I think we're all supportive on this podcast of greater collaboration with FE, and it makes real sense, particularly in the skills agenda at the moment. Particularly as Debbie has outlined, the fact that partnerships between FE and HE, you know, is what will unlock much of this. And there's obviously good examples. I used to work at the University of Hertfordshire, and they've got great partnerships, long-term partnerships with the four colleges in the county. There are other examples at Plymouth, at Sheffield Hallam, and so on. But when the Civic University Network surveyed its members, you know, I was quite surprised this year. I was quite surprised that only half are developing their civic university agreement with their local FE colleges. And I think that's a real indication that while this is, you know, is a big push in terms of policy, when we pitch one, you know, part of tertiary system against the other, it clearly makes collaboration much harder. And there are, you know, pressures where universities and colleges do feel that they're in competition with each other and they can't really collaborate as effectively as they'd like to.
I think Richard's point about demand is really interesting, because that's one of the things that I know vice chancellors have been putting to government and sort of saying, well, you know, it's only worth putting, you know, it's only worth offering things if students want them. But, you know, I do think that there's space for more diversity of options, not just in subject, but in kind of modes of delivery and ways of accessing. I think that's something that's kind of recognised. You know, it might be higher apprenticeships, it might be level four and five plus, but it'll probably be something different again. And that's great. But one of the kind of points that, it was, Liz Barnes at Staffordshire made, and, you know, having worked very closely in that region and thinking about the skills needs, you know, in her experience, part of this is about saying, well, how do we explain the content? You know, so you might have employers saying, well, we need people very skilled in, you know, logistics or kind of retail. And these, you know, these are not ideas to really excite the imagination, but actually it's kind of, so it's breaking, you know, the thing universities are really good at, and this is why universities are really fundamental to this agenda, is breaking down what that means in practice in terms of learning and what the kind of wider skills might be and what sorts of jobs that might prepare you for beyond the kind of, you know, immediate kind of addressing the immediate skills needs. And that's where those jobs of the future are going to come from. That's where the kind of skills of the future are going to come from. And that's why it's really, you know, this is why university insight is really needed as part of this agenda. I mean, that's just one example. I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure there are plenty others.
And now it's time for the hidden history of higher education with Mike Ratcliffe.
Okay, so I think that one of the meta themes of Wonky is how we get universities and policy stuck together. And yeah, there are whole books published on this now, which are excellent. But the best way you could possibly manage this is for universities to have their own MPs. How much fun would that be? And the good news is, for over 600 years, that's what we had. What happened was, beginning of James I and VI's reign, when he came down from Scotland, he wanted to summon a new parliament. And the university thought this was a great way of having their own MP. So Oxford and Cambridge got themselves organised. They had a discussion with the King's ministers about what the best thing to do would be. So the King's ministers wrote back and said, look, on the whole, we'd be good if you didn't send the Vice-Chancellor, send us two people. And they went up to the university's governing body to decide who the two members of Parliament for the two universities would be. And so over time, what happened was that got coalesced, so that people got to have a vote, because they have democratic institutions. And so slowly this became a way of getting to have MPs. And they were just normal MPs after a while. They weren't just representing the university. They just did normal things for the university. So they went through a long line of distinguished people, but not a very distinguished electoral process, because it was just down to the governing body. Everyone who had an MA could vote in it. And therefore, there was an awful lot of what you would have effectively called vote rigging. King sending delegates, the chancellor of the university would nominate somebody, and it was, you know, woe betide the university didn't send them back. So curiously enough, they had one of the university chancellors of Cambridge managed to get his nephew appointed as an MP. He hadn't actually been to Cambridge, so they had to quickly make him a member of Trinity College so that he could be the MP for Cambridge. And everything went off quite happily from there. So this continues. There's a mixture of very enterprising young men who get picked to do this, and sometimes it's safe country gentlemen, and this continues happily until you get to the growth of new universities in the 19th century. And so the University of London manages to persuade Parliament it should have an MP too, and so off they go, and they set up a convocation to do that. The Scots get university MPs as well, and therefore there's a big development of this work. Come the First World War, electoral reform is on everyone's mind. And so there's a parliamentary commission, the Speaker's Commission, that sets out what we should do. And the great thing is that they decide to reform the university MPs, and they do two key things. Firstly, they let the combined universities, the new modern universities, have their own MP, and they let women vote in these elections and stand for them, because this is the same piece of legislation that lets women have the vote. They have to have a special codicil to allow Oxford and Cambridge graduates, because the women aren't allowed to be graduates yet, but they are allowed to stand in the election and vote in the election. But in the parliamentary commission, they thought that single transferable votes would be a good idea. So they actually had single transferable votes for MPs for the university constituencies. It was a postal vote. You got on the register. You're allowed to be on the register of different universities, but you can only vote once in a university constituency. And it was good student union style single transferable votes. And for the period between 1918 and 1948, we had single transferable vote, proportional representation in the UK Parliament, but only for these university constituencies. Now, some of the people were quite distinguished who did this. There was a particularly impressive woman who became the MP for the combined universities, Eleanor Rathbone. She did all sorts of reforming things. But on the whole, there was a mixture between party political people. They weren't too independent. So come the Second World War, the Labour Party comes into power. They start to implement another Speaker's Commission after that, and they decide to go completely against pluralism. So they drop it. And there's a great exchange in Parliament with Winston Churchill, sounding a bit like Boris Johnson, definitely laying into the Socialist Party for this terrible breach of all this historical precedent and how they'd had these wonderful people who'd been MPs for the universities, and it should continue. And Churchill swears that he will bring it back in when he gets back into power. So the Labour Party get rid of it. The 1950 election, there are no university MPs, but strangely enough, it never gets back on the statute board. We do not have university MPs. Plenty of people might think of themselves as a university MP representing a university constituency, but we would have had a separate vote as graduates for our own MPs. An opportunity that no doubt we could try and press for in the future. Get that policy decision back into our education. Let's have our own MPs.
Right. The lesser spotted universities minister has popped up this week, writing to universities with her views on NDAs. Smita, what is all this about?
So, as you say, Michelle Donnellan has written to all higher education providers about the use of non-disclosure agreements, specifically in sexual harassment cases, which she has described as unacceptable, and suggested that legislation is forthcoming to prevent their use. Now, obviously, the use of NDAs is something that has been the subject of much discussion over recent times. We know that sector agencies such as the Office for the Independent Adjudicator aren't keen on the use of NDAs, but we know that many universities continue to use them. And I suppose for me, there are two questions that we really need to ask ourselves. The first is, what is the risk that we're trying to guard against by the use of confidentiality agreements? And sometimes it feels like a knee-jerk reaction. Nobody's actually thought about risk in that context. It's just, yes, if we're reaching a settlement, there should be an NDA. And then the second thing is, even if the risk suggests that there is a threat to confidentiality, is this agreement going to help? Are there better things we could do to actually protect the institution? And I wrote about this probably a couple of years ago now for Wonky, reread it last night and thought, actually, a lot of that still stands good. You know, if you're confident in the decisions you're making, you need to be able to explain them to people. There's no point hoping they will stay quiet, because very little does these days. There is one area where I think it's quite interesting to think about confidentiality, though, and we've seen this increasingly, where a complaint of sexual harassment is made, an institutional process is gone through, and in the end, the complaint is not upheld. And then you have the person who was the subject of the complaint kind of putting pressure on the institution to say, well, how are you going to protect me from ongoing discussion and disclosure of these allegations now that you've been through the process and concluded they're not justified? And I think sometimes that's what institutions are trying to protect, as much as their own reputation, but the interests of people who've been through a process and you know, the process has concluded the allegations are not upheld. And I don't really know what the minister's answer to that is. You know, how do we, given the rights to free speech, et cetera, of everybody involved in this process, how do we stop continued allegations being repeated once the process has concluded? Because we need finality in some way, don't we, through the processes to say this is now over and a decision has been reached. That rarely happens.
Debbie, is there something peculiar to universities going on here, do you think, in the use of NDAs? Or is this sort of organisational behaviour?
Oh, I mean, well, I don't know is the short answer, but I can certainly, I don't know if schools and colleges are using them. Certainly the legislation that Michelle Donnellan referred to in her letter, it applies much more broadly than universities. So the intent is to reduce the use of NDAs in workplace settings across a whole range of issues. So that might be really, and it might be relating to things like whistleblowing as well as sexual harassment. So what that legislation marks is a shift in the kind of public attitude and general practice around the use of NDAs, which suggests, you know, which of course universities would be part of. I think what's interesting about the letter is that Donnellan says that actually there wasn't an intention to include students in that, and Donnellan has signalled that she's going to ask for options as to how students might be included in that legislation, which is forthcoming in due course, and hopefully will show up at some point, you know, in the course of this parliament. But there's also a question about why Michelle Donnellan is writing to universities. And I think,
oh yes, and definitely.
Isn't it great that Smita's going to be on the podcast? Cause we can talk about the legality of ministers writing to autonomous universities and saying, well, here's how you should conduct yourself, whether or not it's the law. And I think that's completely, you know, that was my first thought when I looked at it. I thought, what is this nonsense? But then I read the letter and I thought, hang on a minute. This is a female minister who's met with the leaders of Everyone's Invited. And, you know, and anyone who's been on that website, you only have to spend 5 minutes on there before you're sort of, you know, crying over your keyboard, because my goodness, the suffering and the horror that is going on. And the steer in the letter to sort of suggest that universities should look at the Ofsted review of sexual violence and harassment in schools and adopt that kind of mentality of like, we have to assume it's happening. It is so prevalent. We have to assume it's happening even if it's not being reported, and take steps appropriately. And that's very much in line with Universities UK's position, I think, as well. Although I cannot speak for them. And I do wonder whether this is just an example of a minister sort of saying, well, look, I don't have a lever available to me right now. This is the only lever I have. So all I can do is urge. And sort of perhaps perhaps, you know, perhaps we might sort of see it in that spirit. Although I realise it is also pretty irksome, and I'm really curious about Smita's view on that.
Can I come back on that then, Mark?
Yeah, just quickly. Please do.
So I think that's absolutely right, Debbie, that you know, my lawyerly hackles are always raised once secretaries of state or ministers start writing directly to universities. And in the past, I suppose what would have happened was they would have written to Hefke, and Hefke would have produced a circular letter saying, you know, some to everybody, and we would have found that less questionable in its legality. And I think it says something about the ongoing role of the OFS in all this. And, you know, why isn't the minister talking to the OFS saying, I really want you to raise these issues? And that's partly because the OFS has sort of set its stall out to say, we're not going to get involved in those positive kind of change conversations. That's for providers to do. So it has left a bit of a gap. But I think the other reason that Michelle Donnellan feels able to do it is because there's now a well-established pattern of it. You know, we've had Gavin Williamson writing, we've had Damien Hines writing. And so even though this particular, you know, that classic legal principle of, you know, hard cases make bad law, absolutely in this case, you can see why a minister might want to do this. But it's set against the background of increasing direct correspondence from ministers, which can't be ignored by, you know, which institutions feel they can't ignore or process in the same way that they might the range of other guidance they get from other sources. That's the risk.
Yes, it's really hard as an institution to know what to do with this.
Because
you're not obliged to act on it, but you're sort of, there's a sort of, yeah, the sort of moral pressure. And when it comes from someone in power, that's actually a bit irresponsible, isn't it?
There is that risk that, you know, we get the kind of particular interests of ministers driving institutional behaviour rather than a sort of nuanced approach that looks at all the issues that institutions have got to deal with, you know, across in a more objective way. That's my worry about it. And it feels really harsh to say that when it is a subject that clearly requires attention. And it's very easy to say, well, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, you've got to question the longer term trend here.
And I certainly wouldn't have sympathy for, you know, even if Gavin Williamson feels very, very strongly about you know, admissions, I certainly wouldn't have the same sympathy for him if you know, we're taking, you know, writing to universities on that basis. It is because of the issue that I kind of do feel my heartstrings tugged a little.
Yes, well, on admissions, the law actually prevents him from doing that. Although, I mean, they definitely stray over the boundaries of that plenty of times.
They do indeed. And as lawyers, we don't allow our heartstrings to get tugged that often, Debbie. But absolutely. There are topics that we've just got to say, this is not an appropriate way to deal with. However much it needs dealing with, this is not the way to do it.
Smita, I'm struck by what you're saying about kind of where these NDAs come from. And it almost sort of sounds like a sort of bureaucratic juggernaut. It's or kind of a matter of process. You know, if you go through these processes and then an NDA is standard at the end of it, is kind of the problem that this is sort of emerge out of kind of inertia rather than proactive decision making. And how would you advise a university to tackle that?
I hate to say this because it feels slightly disloyal to my profession, but I think it comes from a narrowly legal interpretation of risk. So I think that, you know, if you asked a lawyer, what's the best way of protecting the sort of confidentiality of a situation, they would obviously say, right, yep, get somebody to sign up to a confidentiality agreement, because that's the legal mechanism to do it. Big question marks about enforceability, big questions about whether they actually change behaviour. I think institutions need to see risk in a broader way, though, because yes, there's the legal risk that somebody's going to reveal to the world that they've been through a difficult case and they don't think the university's handled it. But I think that there's the wider risk of people just seeing it as having something to hide, even when you don't. So I think, as I said in the blog I wrote, my feeling is you need to be able to explain to people what you have done to deal with this really, really very difficult set of scenarios about sexual harassment, rather than relying on the ability to hide it. So I think legally that's always going to be something that's recommended, but actually in practice it doesn't work. So let's find a better way of explaining what universities are doing here.
Just want to pick up what Smita said there about risk, which I'm, you know, obviously Smita's the legal expert on this panel. So there's no way I can sort of, you know, contradict what she says in that respect. But on risk, which I completely agree with, is the wider risk to institutions for storing up these issues. And clearly what matters is the safeguarding of their students and making sure that they're in a safe environment. But we've seen, particularly in the school sector in recent weeks, and I live in South East London, so the three private schools near me, Dulwich College, Jags and Alains, have obviously been in the news about a lot of these issues. Just this week, big story about Colchester Grammar School, which is one of the, in terms of attainment, one of the strongest schools in the country, but has been given an inadequate Ofsted judgment as a result of all of this, and it's because of students or alumni from those schools, raising their voices, and rightly so, around the sort of experiences that they've faced. And I think universities, if they rely too heavily on NDAs and things like that, they're going to store up trouble, because there's going to be, their alumni and others are going to, have powerful stories about what's happened to them. And we do need to think about risk in a more holistic way, with putting the needs of students and ensuring that they are supported at the heart of this.
So that's about it for this week and this series. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thanks to Richard, Smita, Debbie, all our other fabulous guests from across this season, and everyone at Wonky that makes it happen behind the scenes. And until September, stay safe, stay wonky. Until September, stay safe, stay wonky. I'll do that last bit again. And until September, stay safe.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's just nonsense.